I remember teaching at that music store, teaching a young girl. She was about 6 years old, very bright, very receptive. And I figured out really quickly that teaching is not telling. You know, I have all this knowledge and she's smart. She should be getting this. And it really made me look inward. And it was kind of when I started to realize, okay, I'm missing something. I know all this stuff. I know what to teach, but I don't know how to teach it.
Welcome to the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast, the place where teachers from around the world meet to share innovative ideas about music education. Listen and learn as we help you motivate your students, grow your income, expand your studio, and become a more creative piano teacher.
G'day everyone and welcome back to the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast. You're listening to episode number 111, and if you're one of my Inner Circle Piano Teaching Community members, a very special welcome to you. My name is Tim Topham, your host for the show today, and if this is your first time here, thank you so much for tuning in. It means a lot to me. The Creative Piano Teaching Podcast is a place where you can get weekly inspiration, ideas, business and teaching strategies to help support you, your teaching and grow your studio. Today's show notes and a full transcript are available at timtopham.com/episode111. This episode of the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast is proudly sponsored by the Selviano Grand Hybrid Piano, a digital hybrid piano created by Casio in conjunction with acoustic piano manufacturer C. Bexton. And as you've heard me mention before, there are huge benefits, in my opinion, to hybrid digital pianos, just like hybrid cars. Of course, you've got the lower running costs because your piano never needs tuning and can be moved around the house by just you or you and a friend. You can use headphones with it so people can practice or play at any time at once. Great for group teaching because you can have two sets of headphones, in fact. You've got support for USB, apps and recording. You can split the keyboard, layer sounds, play along with their integrated accompaniments. And if you want to hear me try and do that with a piano concerto live on Facebook, you can go to my Facebook channel and actually watch my review on there. It's I didn't get very far, put it that way. You actually get with this instrument three pianos in one. The C. Bechstein piano, a Steinway, full sample, 7-foot Steinway and Bösendorfer as their three kind of flagship instruments involved in there. And the great thing is for me as well, as a teacher, I don't have a huge amount of money to throw around for instruments like this. So I really like that their price points start at about $5,000. So visit www.soundtechnology.com.au for more information, and you can find out where you can buy. And I'd highly recommend finding a dealer who has these and go and play one today. This is the first podcast in the last theme of this year, which is all about beginning as a piano teacher. So not teaching beginners, but actually being a beginner teacher. And I wanted to cover this, and we're going to go into lots of detail in this month, which is November 2017, because I know what it's like to start as a piano teacher. I started my teaching career quite some time ago, now 20 years ago. But I've only been a piano teacher full-time for a much shorter amount of that period. And so I actually know the feeling of being a new piano teacher and some of those concerns. And so this month, we're going to be focusing on helping new piano teachers settle in, get themselves set up correctly with both the business side and the pedagogical side, and really support new teachers all around the world. Now, my guest today brings an eclectic mix of classical, jazz, blues, and contemporary styles to both his teaching and performing. Current teaching engagements include the Lamont School of Music Piano Preparatory Program and a small private piano studio. He holds a Bachelor of Music degree in jazz performance from the Western Michigan University and is pursuing a Master of Music degree at the University of Denver. My guest today is a relatively new teacher, which is why I wanted to get him onto the podcast today so we can actually find out what kinds of things that he's been having issues with or worrying about and the ways that he's approaching his teaching as a relatively new teacher. And I had the pleasure of meeting him in person at the 88 Creative Keys Workshops in Denver earlier this year. He's a superstar teacher and all-around nice guy. Welcome to the show, Joe Harkins.
Hey, thank you, Tim. My pleasure. So honored to be here.
So very cool to hang out with you. It was great fun to meet you in Denver this year. Firstly, how old are you for people listening?
I'm 24.
24. And so when did you first start learning piano? And I want you to give us your biggest takeaway from some of your earlier lessons.
Yeah, I was a little bit late to the game. I was 11 or 12. Luckily, I had an uncle who was musical, and he kind of got me started. And shortly after that, I started kind of the traditional path for a young kid in Michigan. And you just find a music store and, oh, they teach piano there. Let me check it out. So I think my biggest takeaway from those early lessons was that I really did love to play. I wanted to go to lessons. Unfortunately, I had a teacher who was very understanding that of me, that I liked a lot of styles. I liked classical, I liked jazz, I liked pop. And she would pull all kinds of music and was very encouraging.
That's so important, of course. And yeah. Did you find that she had an understanding of these areas of music teaching, or was she kind of learning as she went? Was it a bit out of her comfort zone to support you in those all those genres?
Definitely out of her comfort zone. She's kind of a typical church organist, church pianist, a very good reader. I was working on ragtime music a lot, and she would actually go and learn it so she could teach me. It was really kind of a cool experience to see somebody invest that much time in you.
I loved the ragtime. I have to say that out of any written form of music, ragtime really hooked me as a kid. Mm-hmm. Totally loved it and loved teaching it as well. Do you know when if you look back to those days when she was teaching you, do you know where she was, apart from teaching herself the music first, was she doing anything off the page, sort of improvisationary, chord-based, jazz-based with you at that stage?
No, not in her own playing and definitely not in her teaching.
Right.
She was fairly old, maybe almost 80. So she was kind of on the way out as far as teaching.
Just for anyone who's listening who's 80, you're on the way out. Plenty of years left.
On the way out of teaching. She's actually still living, and I think she's almost 90 now, and she's still playing in church, still shredding. So very cool. I didn't mean on the way out, like kick the bucket, but definitely done teaching.
So you're obviously into jazz, and towards the end of the workshops in Denver, we actually heard you jam with Bradley Sowash, who's probably listening to this. Hello, Bradley. you guys really put on a show for us all. When did you get into jazz?
I was about 17 or 18, just before college. I had a really good mentor and friend who really encouraged me to look at jazz programs for my music study. And like I said, I was working a lot on the Joplin rags, and that kind of naturally leads into stride piano and jazz piano. So I started listening to ragtime, and then figured out who Art Tatum was and that whole lineage of jazz pianists, and the rest kind of history. Then I was just hooked. So I ended up pursuing jazz for my bachelor's degree.
Right. And you did a performance bachelor's?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it was a jazz piano focus.
Yes.
There you go. So would you today call yourself a jazz teacher, or do you just do a bit of jazz on the side?
Yeah, I definitely would call myself a jazz teacher. Right. I think my favorite quote that would apply to this would be Duke Ellington's, I'm paraphrasing, good music is good music. So I really hope to kind of have a complete approach for my students. If they're not in love with jazz, that's okay. But I want them to create and improvise. It's really kind of what made me love the piano. It's the ability to do those things.
And I'm going to ask you a little bit later on about some of your goals for the future, but would you like to see yourself as someone who is the go-to jazz teacher in your area, like jazz specialist, like hardcore, knows weird Mixolydian modes and whatever else with the jazz? or are you quite keen to be, as you say, an all-round teacher?
I would rather be an all-around teacher, in my opinion. It's kind of like my curse, right? Jack of all trades, master of none. But in a way, that's a really good thing. I really, really take a lot of pride in teaching the young student up to the high school student. I'm going to leave the wizardry to all those college professors who are far beyond anything I could ever improvise.
Yeah, I think I'm a bit of a jack of all trades as well, and I've always enjoyed that, being able to mix with any students, take them from wherever they are in their journey and move them along the path. I think it's a great approach. So tell us how you came to be teaching piano now, and did you always think of this as a career for you?
Well, I knew I loved music and I wanted to do music, but like every undergraduate college student, You do not think you're going to be teaching. You think you're going to be performing. But about halfway through my undergraduate studies, I started a little music appreciation series at a local nursing home. I wanted to just find a way to give back. And it turned out to be one of the best things I ever did. I had to speak in front of people. And granted, some could hear you, some couldn't. They were all encouraging. It was a safe space, but you're still nervous, right? You're in front of a group of people. So I also have to thank my teacher, Jeremy Siskind. He was probably the biggest supporter of that little music appreciation series. And he actually played a recital for it. And shortly after that recital that he gave, he handed me a bag full of method books. It was the Faber and Faber Piano Adventures. And he said, you know, you've got a gift for teaching and I think you need to explore it. And so that whole long-winded point is that I didn't really think I was going to teach, but it kind of happens.
Right, as it does for many of us. And how great that Jeremy, I mean, those words were obviously very powerful for you to hear and to have that mentorship of, you know what, you've got a gift for this. You need to be looking into this. I think that is so important. And for people listening who are more experienced teachers, you know, these are the kinds of things that we can do for potential future teachers who might be sitting there in our studio or have just left or be friends of families and things like that. You can have an amazing impact, as Jeremy obviously did on you, Joe. So
definitely.
Take us through your music studies. So we heard you had an older teacher, but she was really happy to teach you a whole lot of different things. As a child, then in your late teens, you started doing some jazz. We've heard that you've done a bit of, you did a bachelor's in jazz. Just take us through your actual studies.
You mean after my studies, after the bachelor's degree?
So after the jazz at school, so when you were 17, we kind of left off, what actually happened after that?
Yeah, so I ended up at Western Michigan University. And the good thing about that program is for your first 2 years of study, if you are a jazz pianist, you also have to be a classical pianist. So you're doing double duty. You're doing your proficiency recitals, exams at the end of each year in both jazz and classical music. Wow. But I ended up going the jazz route. For a time, I saw all that classical repertoire as just work. I had to get it done so that I could have the treat of only playing jazz. But I loved it. I was around people who were extremely talented. The faculty there was amazing. Some still there, some have moved on. But the one thing that I remember about that program was the interaction with living jazz greats, like drummer Billy Hart. I could probably go on and on, so I'll stop there. But I mean, anybody who knows jazz knows who Billy Hart is. Wow. Fred Hirsch would be a big piano name. Ed Simon. These people would come every semester, every year. You're playing with them, learning for them. I almost felt like I was in a dream, you know? Like, I don't even belong on the same stage as these guys. What's happening? So it was really a cool experience and just kind of further cemented my love for improvised music.
Right. And then so that was your bachelor's. And then after that is what you're doing now. Is that right?
Right. So after that, I would say a lot of real world experience. I had a solo piano gig for a hotel, a little island in northern Michigan. Really fun gig.
Well, it was actually on an island.
It was. Yep. In Lake Huron, one of the Great Lakes. Yeah. It was cool. So kind of like a cruise ship gig, if you want to think of it like that.
Right.
Playing 7 nights a week really stretches your creativity, your technique, your posture. So it was fun. And then in that kind of between school time, I also did some teaching. I taught for the Irving Gilmore International Keyboard Festival. They had a little inner city program, and I helped run the after school piano program. Not run it, but teach it, help teach for it. And got to work in a group setting with kids, and that was so rewarding, really fun. And then I also did the music store thing, kind of like my first teacher. I taught at a music store and had about 20 students. So just a lot of playing and teaching in between college work.
Yeah, and I want to pick up on that for those other newer teachers who might be listening to this, that we all go through these very varied, well, most of us very varied stages of playing while we're trying to make a living, and we'll do some teaching on the side, and we might play in church, or we'll be in a band or whatever it is. And it's often our teaching careers often come out of a very mixed experience at some stage of doing a whole lot of different things. And for me, it was a whole lot of non-musical things for quite some time as well. So, you know, everyone's path's a little bit different. I love hearing I mean, I also worked in a restaurant. I certainly didn't do 7 nights a week. That would have, I think, driven me crazy. particularly when you're playing. Were you sort of playing while people were eating and having cocktails and that sort of thing?
Excuse me. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like a dinner shift, 6 to 10 p.m.
kind of. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it can be quite – I mean, if people actually recognize you and give you the odd clap or come and say something to you, it's nice. But it's a pretty thankless task for most of the time, I found.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
And the other thing too, you said with regard to the classical music, you just wanted to finish it up so you could play jazz because that was all the hard work or some words to that effect. It was very similar. I went through classical exams for many years, and my teacher said, "Look, once you've done your grade six exam, I'm going to let you go and do some jazz with another teacher who's a friend of mine." And so I think we've got a very similar little background there. All I wanted to do was finish and stop having to play classical music so I could go and do jazz. Funnily enough, now what do I like playing? I love playing classical music. So
same. I came back on my knees. Let me back into school, yeah. And now I'm studying. That's what my graduate work is: classical music, filling those holes. And I'm just like, how did I ever want to give this up? You know,
it's funny, yeah. Isn't it? So yeah. Look, I want to take you back to when you first started teaching. Now, can you remember that first student or class? Tell us about him or her or the situation. I'd love to know sort of if it was in your home studio or at someone's music studio. Take us back to that beginning.
Yeah. So a little bit of two things. I remember teaching at that music store, teaching a young girl. She was about 6 years old, very bright, very receptive. And I figured out really quickly that teaching is not telling. You know, I have all this knowledge and she's smart. She should be getting this. And it really made me look inward. And it was kind of when I started to realize, okay, I'm missing something. I know all this stuff. I know what to teach, but I don't know how to teach it. That's probably the biggest thing I remember. And then again, that music appreciation series, I remember having to pre-plan phrases, something for me to latch onto. I love to improvise, but of course you have to have something to go off of. You have to have a plan. So those would be my big takeaways from that early teaching.
Mm. And what did you do when you realized you had the knowledge, but you didn't know how to teach it, for example, with that young girl?
Yeah, I would try to come up with phrases or games or activities beforehand, before the lesson. You know, the first couple of weeks was very reactionary, and I was like, okay, this is not going to work. This isn't going to cut it. But on the flip side, sometimes in your lesson, you do have to improvise. If what you planned so well isn't working for that child, you have to find a different way. And again, I was struggling with that. I wasn't always finding a different way to help her understand something. It was frustrating for me. She was an angel. She was just having fun, loved playing the piano. So
right.
I think most of it was on me, you know.
Did you have any resources to fall back on?
Not really. I was out of school at that point. I was still in contact with a few teachers at the university, Western Michigan University. Shortly after some of those lessons with her, I said, okay, I need to look into pedagogy. And I was actually talking to an old friend who had just started her graduate work in pedagogy. And she said, hey, you need to do this. Here's a couple of things I read for class this week. You need to get back in the game. And I did. Then I started preparing for auditions.
Right. So it really was a needs-based reason that you went back and you sought the pedagogy training. You realized in your lessons, I kind of know this, but I'm kind of drowning a little bit. I need some help. And that's where you're able to find it. And that's what you're doing, the work that you're doing now, right? At Denver University. Yeah. Great. And we'll find out a little bit more about that in a moment. Did you use any, did you find anyone online, books, YouTubes, anything like that that helped, or really did you not find any of that useful?
Yeah, I'm not sure how hard I looked. A lot of it was, hey, I'm teaching this kid this piece. Can you help me? I did lean on a few teachers that I knew from the area. What I did start doing was reading the teacher manuals or the teacher guides that would often come with the book. So I got the Faber series, like the teacher guides. I started kind of watching Randall Faber's videos online, trying to pick up on, you know, what was he doing? What was he about? But you know, I was just missing. I could tell you what I was missing, but you know, that would just be a laundry list of things I've learned in pedagogy.
And I mean, even looking at those videos and grabbing bits and pieces here and there, I guess one of the big things you're missing is the big picture too, the mm-hmm. the actual sequence of activities through and progression and all of that.
Absolutely.
And look, many of us start. I know there'll be many teachers listening to this kind of nodding and going, you know what, I started like that as well. I certainly did. Many of us do, because pedagogy training isn't that common around the world. It's more common in America than other places, in my experience. But there's still many more teachers than there are people who've gone through pedagogy courses. So there's a lot who learnt by doing what you did at the start, just there's a kid in front of me. Quick, I better find a method book. I better teach us a piece of music. And then you start to, you know, start researching where you can actually get some more skills from. So that's great. So did you start with only young children, or did you have some teenagers, or have you ever taught adults right at the beginning?
Yeah, I actually had a mix of all three, teaching at that music studio. The most rewarding student that I had from my short time there was a retired school teacher. And, you know, I even told her, I said, I know there's some gaps in what I'm trying to do here. Let's kind of work together. So she would say, well, I'm missing this, I'm needing this. That was actually a really cool, I just remembered that, really cool thing. And then I had young students, and that was mostly fine. You know, it's a positive and a negative, I think, of some of those beginning methods. If you do just stick to the book, your kids will learn in a sequenced, you know, idea of instruction. So I kind of leaned heavily on that. But I had two high school students. They were homeschooled, very dedicated, very polite, very respectful, and they could play. And they were playing Haydn and Mozart sonatas. And, you know, here's me. I did a jazz studies degree, and I played one Mozart sonata and one Haydn sonata as part of my coursework. And just survived.
You had to.
Yes. And I could really tell, wow, there's, you know, I need to let these kids go. I'm holding them back at this point. Right. And that was another big moment for me. I need to go back and come back to this classical music a little bit.
Wow. I'm finding so many parallels with my own experience of taking on a student who was playing the G flat major Impromptu by Schubert, which many people will know. You probably have played it. And I realized when I listened to this kid playing in their first lesson with me, and it was a trial lesson, admittedly, that I actually didn't really know how to help them. They were playing it really, really well, and I didn't know the next step. And that was a big wake-up call for me to go and find out more and start playing at a more advanced level myself as well.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you started teaching at a music school. What did you find were the benefits or negatives of that experience as a new teacher?
As a new teacher, my favorite part about it was that they had a little office for their music school, and they handled everything. If somebody didn't show up, they handled it. If I couldn't show up, I called in, they handled it, they rescheduled. Payment was handled. I didn't have to deal with angry parents. I didn't have to make my own contract. The downside, of course, is you make a little bit less money. But there was a studio space with a well-tuned upright acoustic piano. So it was kind of like, hey, here you go, teach. It was really nice. You've got everything you need. So for me, that was the biggest upside.
And did they dictate or recommend you use this particular method or this approach to teaching? Or was it you teach as you feel fit?
Nope. The only thing that they would kind of keep an eye on is if you had some kind of lesson assignment and that you followed through on it and always, you know, we're kind of following through on last week's work, teaching something new, but that was about it. I mean, literally that was almost word for word what I read in my contract, you know, so nothing about my own lesson plan, just having an assignment for the student and reviewing and adding new. So it's like they tried, but didn't want to pigeonhole you. I don't know. I don't want to go too far down that road, but
yeah. Well, and it is hard as someone who has employed other teachers before. You don't want to dictate everything that they do, because we all come with our own methods and approaches to teaching, and no one way is right or wrong, and it suits different people differently. So it doesn't surprise me that that was the case, although it sounds like in some ways it might have been easier if they had said, this is our approach, you need to follow this.
Sure, yeah.
Would you recommend this kind of experience to other new teachers, i.e.,
absolutely,
working in a music school to start with?
Absolutely. You know, I would kind of peek in. I'll have to admit, I would peek in on other lessons or kind of stand around the corner. The studios were not soundproofed at all. And I would listen. I would see what the other teachers were doing. And, you know, some of it was very bad. And I hate to say that, you know, I'm not going to call anybody out specifically, but, you know, a lot of people just, let's turn the page, let's do this. You know, if you just press harder or just hearing things like that where, you know, I knew that it wasn't right. So for me, it was good to see that you could be better. And I'm not hating on music studios, because there was a lot of good instruction that I actually learned from. There was one studio I would sit outside the door and listen. I would cop his phrases and things he was doing. So I think it's good for people to kind of, it's a good way to get your feet wet without having to manage all the details. You show up, you agree to work for someone, and they give you students. And it's very quickly, I had 20 students I was teaching. So it was a good experience.
Yeah. And it is good experience to see and hear good and bad teaching as well, because you know which way that you'd prefer not to go and which way you would like to go. So I think that is helpful. All right. So if you can take us back again, what were your biggest worries as a very first new beginner teacher? Have you got two or three that you can think of? Really worried me all the time.
Yeah. Well, I was concerned that there were a lot of holes in my own learning, not just classically, even in some of my jazz studies. I think I probably skipped over most of the intermediate level in my own learning, because I did have a lot of natural ability and my teachers were just kind of throwing new stuff at me. So there were a lot of holes for me. I didn't know what to give my students because I never really played a lot of that intermediate repertoire. And now I'm figuring that out the hard way in graduate school as I go back and learn some of those pieces and how to teach them and prepare them. The other big thing for me was I was concerned if I was practicing well or not. You know, if it wasn't efficient or correct, how was I going to teach my students to be good practicers? So those were probably my two biggest reservations when I got started.
That's an interesting one. So you're actually unsure of your own ability to be effective in your practice.
Yeah. I know it's effective, but how effective? Is it the most effective way?
Right.
And I've since learned, no, it was not, you know.
Well, let's dig into that briefly, because this is a really important thing for any new teacher. What were you, now as you look back, what were you doing in your practice that wasn't efficient, and what do you help students with now?
Yeah, right now, well, then I was very much big picture. I mean, I would find a half hour had gone by and I had just played the piece from beginning to end. And not, I don't know if it's just because I didn't realize it or because I was just excited to see what was next and keep going. The other thing is, it sounds obvious, but I don't know that I was ever committing to consistent fingerings and really religiously learning them. So I wasn't able to train that neurological pathway, that muscle memory when I was practicing. Another big thing I figured out was I was just practicing too long and in too big of the sections were too big. You know, take four bars, really learn those four bars, see what they're all about. When you come back an hour later or tomorrow, you'd be surprised. But see, I was taking 8, 16 bar, a page, two pages, just too much.
Yep.
So I was doing some things well. I was working on repetition and efficiency, setting a timer, setting goals. It was just too much. So those were some of the things that I noticed from my old practicing versus how I practice now.
Right. So those worries were pretty real and relevant for you. Did you have any that you look back on and go, ugh, I shouldn't have, why was I worried about that?
I was worrying way too much in my beginning teaching about every small, tiny detail, whereas the big picture approach is so important. I've heard that in my studies here. I especially hear that with Leela every week, Leela Viss, working with her at DU. Don't forget the big picture. You know, she says that a lot, and it's so true.
You even sounded like her just then.
It's so true, right? Yeah.
And so by that, we mean the what do you mean by that, rather than putting words in your mouth?
If you have a student who shows up and he has the notes and the rhythms learned, but his knuckles buckled a little bit and he didn't get the dynamics in bar four, do you freak out about those two things, or do you sit down and play the duet with them and see what else you can pull out of it? Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
Kind of making things into a teaching moment. Use what there already is. Worry about maybe assign an etude next week that deals with that curved knuckle problem, but don't beat up somebody about a small detail. you know, they worked hard to play that small song for you. Why would you beat them up about the, you know, the minutiae?
Yeah, yeah. Or spending a whole lesson on that one thing.
Yes, and therefore, yes, the
whole,
exactly.
The whole lesson is wasted in some ways. I remember seeing, and this happens in masterclasses. I don't know if you've been to like high level advanced masterclasses where there's some on YouTube where the master, like literally the student starts playing and they play their first note, boom, and they're like, no, wait, we need to start again. Oh, and they'll start, they'll work on that first note because it's so important that to the master teacher that is right. I love that approach. You know, it's all of this stuff is important, the hand position, adding dynamics and things. But yeah, let's get the bigger picture. I like that use of the term bigger picture in that regard. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
How did you have money, etc., to buy books and things like that back in those days?
Money. I sold a kidney. No, I still play church gigs. I played a lot of church gigs then. And before I was done with school, and as I was starting that beginning teaching, I had already landed the Mackinac Island gig, and that was a pretty good gig. They paid for my living. And I had a tip jar. So if you knew how to read
on the island.
Lived on the island and they put me up. It was great.
Wow.
So I didn't really have any expenses and I had a tip jar. And if you knew how to read a crowd, you could really make some money.
Wow.
So I saved a lot. I just pinching pennies. I don't know how else to say it. Sometimes you call home, you swallow your pride and say, hey, I need $50. I need this book. I can't afford it. But most of the time I was able to manage. Yeah. Another thing is teaching creatively. You don't have to buy six books. Buy a couple and see what you can get out of them.
I like it. Yeah. You use those books for a whole lot of great activities that you pulled out of them. Yeah. What a fun story. I had no idea you were living literally immersed in this island job. What a classic.
We could talk about that for a whole nother segment, I'm sure.
And hang on, you said if you could read a crowd, tell us what does that mean? What did you do?
If you have six families sitting in front of you, are you just going to play cocktail jazz or are you going to throw in Disney tunes? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then before you know it, the little 5-year-old is wandering up with a $5 bill in their hand. And then they want to be your buddy. A lot of times I would definitely play the crowd. A little kid would walk up. It's cute, right? They put their money in the tip jar. They can barely see over the piano. And you say, hey, come over here. And you just do some kind of pentatonic or E-flat blues. And they jam with you for a couple minutes and everyone loves it, right? The kid is excited. The family's excited. Everyone in the restaurant's excited. So those kind of things, just kind of letting people know you see them, you're paying attention. A lot of times you would just hear somebody say, I wonder if the piano player can play that Brahms intermezzo. And I pull it up on my iPad and play it and they freak out. They don't even realize you can hear them at the piano. So just little things like that, you know, help you fill the jar.
Very cool. So what have been the most important things that you've picked up from your pedagogy studies so far? If you could narrow it down.
I know. Yeah, it's so hard to narrow down. My biggest takeaways are lesson planning, having clear objectives, the art of the question. So why are you asking a question? Are you asking a yes or no question? Or can your question lead to some independent thought? And then a willingness to abandon your lesson plan if it's needed. If a kid had a rough week, something went on at home, or they really excelled at a small part of one of their assignments and you decide to run with it instead of worrying about every other small thing on their assignment page. And then the big picture idea, which we kind of already talked about.
Yeah.
Those would be my big takeaways so far.
Yeah. No, that's great. And just dive a little bit deeper into question technique, what you've learned about that and what teachers listening can try literally in their lesson today.
Something I've found helpful, and this is with my young students at the Lamont preparatory program, they'll come in and they'll play four bars and it's a two-bar phrase, something that repeats, and they'll tank the second two bars. And instead of just saying, did you get that right? I always say, let's look at bar one and bar three. What can you tell me about bar three? I don't even say, are they the same? I'll say, what can you tell me about bar one and bar three? And you can kind of just see the gears moving inside their little brains. And then, oh, it's the same. And then you say bar five, bar nine, you know,
right.
You point it out. But they're learning to see and analyze. You're not just going to say, okay, let's analyze this music. If you ask the right question, you lead them toward it.
Oh, so good to hear this, Joe, from someone yeah. who's quite young and new to all this. That's taken many of us listening decades to get our head around what you've just said, and it is so powerful. That idea of helping students think and learn themselves, which is so important, by asking the right questions. I think that is the biggest, such a big takeaway from today. So yeah, really well said.
Awesome.
You're studying currently with Lee Levis, as we've mentioned, who'll probably be
yes.
listening to this, and Chihua Tan as well, right?
Absolutely.
Both of whom are expert teachers, fantastic all around people, and very well respected in their field. So you're in a very lucky little niche there, I think. What has anything in particular stuck out in your learning from those two people in particular recently? I mean, we've mentioned Leela perhaps. So was there anything from Chihua, for example, that really stands out in your experience?
Yeah. Okay. You got to forgive me. I mean, a shameless plug, because it like you said, it's an incredible experience. It's a pedagogy dream team. It really is. If you're listening right now and you're thinking about graduate school, come figure out how to make it to Denver. Denver itself is awesome, but specifically the pedagogy program here, it's just incredible. The thing that I like is that both of these women are amazing, respected in their field. People know about them. People like them. They're just good all-around human beings.
Right.
But they both have cutting-edge pedagogical knowledge. And at the same time, they have different ways of going about achieving that, about different ways to impart it to their students. So I feel like I'm getting the best of both worlds, so to speak. Chihua has that sound, time-tested pedagogical background, and Leela also has that, but includes a lot of technology, cutting-edge research, what's going on now. I think that would be the biggest takeaway for me from both of them, actually, is what's going on now. Chihua is very good at saying, well, this is how you used to teach this pedagogical sequence, and here are the seven ways you can do it now, because seven smart people came up with a new way. And then with Leela, kind of piggybacking on that, she'll say, well, there's seven ways to do it, and here's seven apps to help you do that.
Yeah.
So it's just all of this awesome knowledge and new ways to present it. I mean, I have no excuse not to be creative in my teaching. I should never teach something the same way twice. They give so much feedback and good knowledge. One quick thing. We video our teaching every week, and Leela watches it, some of it. Chihua watches some of it, and they give us feedback. I mean, how cool is that, you know,
yeah.
to say, hey, Joe, you were really close. You almost did what you tried to do there. What if you did this? It's just, I don't really have words for it. It's so great to have somebody like that, a master teacher, telling you how you can be better, watching yourself teach on video and giving you instant feedback. It's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so meaningful. And it's why classroom teaching, when you are a student teacher in a classroom situation, that's what happens all the time. That is the part where you learn the most, is your teaching rounds. That's what we call them here in Australia anyway, where you go and you're assessed taking someone else's class. So, so powerful. So I'm really glad that they're doing that and you're getting a lot out of it. That's great.
Yeah.
And I should say too that for those of you who love Leela, and we all love Leela on this podcast, she's actually on the next episode 112. And you mentioned actually earlier, Joe, lesson planning was something that you realized that you needed help with. And so Leela is actually on next week to talk all about her approach to lesson planning and the work that she's doing with students just like Joe. So make sure you tune into that one next week. All right. So we're going to wrap up with just a couple of last questions. You mentioned quickly then technology. How have you incorporated technology in your teaching so far? And are you using particular devices or what's your approach with that?
So this is actually the first year that I've had an iPad, my studio iPad. So this is the first year I've actually been able to really incorporate technology. I did a few things with my iPhone before that, but I'm using a lot of iReel Pro. It's an app that was featured at 88 Creative Keys, the conference. That's an app that I used for so long as a jazz performer and never realized it was a great educational tool. So I'm using that app a ton. The kids love creating their own chord charts, taking ownership of the new chords they learn every week. So it's been a good compositional tool as well. Yeah. Great app. Good app. Is. Very versatile.
And it's for every platform too. And yes, so it's named IREAL Pro. iReal Pro. Yeah, go on.
iReal Pro. Yeah. We've been using Flashnote Derby a lot. Good note recognition game. Yep. Yeah. I use Tenuto a lot with my older students. Same kind of idea, but it's not presented in the way of a game. It's just here it is. Let's see what we can do. It's a good flashcard app. The other thing I do a lot is I record my students playing in the lesson and let them watch it and have them self-assess what's going on. And we talk about it. That's probably been the biggest motivator for some of my students. He's going to record me and I can't lie about it or say, oh, I did that or oh, I didn't do that. And some of my kids have even started recording themselves at home. That's making a huge difference in their practicing.
Yeah, it's just like having someone sitting and watching, but it's just the iPad. Anyone can do it, or an iPhone, any phone really. Great little tips that anyone can use there. And what about professional development? Have you been able to make use of any conferences or workshops in your area, anything like that?
Yeah, other than attending the national conferences, which are great, I've been working with the Columbine Music Teachers Association a little bit. I performed for one of their, they have a boys recital every year. So I went and played some jazz for that.
Oh, cool.
And then they had me at one of their meetings about a month or two ago. And I talked about some considerations for beginning improv, how to get beginner and intermediate students hooked on some improv, ways they can teach it, things they can do, apps they can use. And then I'm going to be working with a little nonprofit called Colorado Composes. And I'm going to do a little video for them on composing with jazz song form. And I think I'll work with some students as well. They have an online portal set up where I get to see their composition, give them feedback as they write it. So I'm really looking forward to working with those young composers.
Wow. So at age 24 and a relatively new teacher, you're already teaching other people, giving workshops effectively and performing.
Yeah. I don't know about awesome. We'll see how effective it is. Maybe you come see one and you might take that back. No, it's been great. My favorite student right now is actually a teacher. She's a piano teacher from the Columbine group, and she wanted some jazz lessons. So we meet every other week, and it is so much fun teaching a teacher. You wouldn't believe it. You know, she's the only teacher I've taught, but she's the best student I've ever had. You know, I can just see her, thinking about how she'll teach it as she's learning it. It's really cool process. I don't even consider it teaching. It's just, hey, here's this thing you didn't know about. Let me show you.
Wow.
And she's already been incorporating some of our blues and beginning jazz tools into her teaching. It's been really fun.
Very cool. Well, yeah. last question before we wrap up. Was there anything you wish you had been taught by people earlier on or told about piano teaching that you weren't?
How to practice. I wish my first four teachers, not until my last teacher in undergrad, did we really start talking about, hey, how are you practicing? That's the biggest thing for me. If I'd known the basics of it even before I got to college, I would have been a far better learner and teacher. So that would be the one kind of regret I have. But to flip it, you know, it's kind of good. It's good that I've struggled with practicing because now I'm really good at teaching it to my students.
How good is this guy, everyone? It's been so good hanging out with you, Joe, and I know everyone listening will have enjoyed the conversation. We obviously wish you all the best in the rest of your studies. How long have you got to left of your studies before you are out in the big wide world?
Yeah, I know. Only a few more months in the incubator to take advantage. I'll be done in June coming up this year, June 2018.
Right. And so what's the plan? What's the plan for the future after that?
Yeah, start my studio. I'm not sure where it's going to be, renting a space or out of where I live, out of the home.
Mm-hmm.
But I got to get that rolling. I'm going to have a website up in the spring. I'm working on that right now.
Yep.
I have a few things to record still. I want to have some content before I have a website. So
yeah, good for you.
I'm going to launch that in the spring and start teaching.
Good stuff, Joe. Very, very, what's the word? Inspirational, I guess, listening to someone really new to the profession, so eager, You've thought about a lot of what you're doing. You're really passionate, obviously, and I know your students are going to benefit hugely from having you as a teacher. I really look forward to keeping in touch with you as well. Where can people find out more about you at the moment? Have you got any web presence, Facebook pages, anything like that?
I'm on Facebook, Joseph Harkins. There's probably a lot of Joseph Harkins, but look for me. I got a little picture of me playing piano. And then the Lamont Piano Preparatory page, I would direct people there. There's a nice little bio and more about what I get to do, all the awesome stuff I get to participate in. That's really my focus right now, is finishing strong here at school.
Yeah.
And then the website will come up in the spring.
That's great. Well, we've got some training resources on website building and updating and all that. If it's of any use, let me know. I'll shoot something through.
I'll be reading it.
Yeah. That's great. Thanks so much for joining us today, Joe. It's been an absolute pleasure.
All right. Thank you for those kind words. Thank you for having me. It's been awesome.
Not at all. So remember, guys, that next week, as I mentioned before, we've got the fabulous Leela Viss on the show talking all about effective lesson planning for new teachers. I cannot wait to share that. And look, thanks to everyone too who have left reviews on Facebook recently and iTunes. I really appreciate it. I read them all. It means a lot that people have the time to go and do it. It only takes a few minutes. And if you are interested in supporting the work that I do on this podcast by leaving a review, you can head to timtopham.com/review, and that will give you the process for either a Facebook or an iTunes review. So hopefully you can get a chance to do that. It only takes a couple of minutes. All right, everyone. Looking forward to catching you next week when I interview Leela. Until then, see you later.
We'll conclude this evening's entertainment.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast. We'd love to help take your teaching to the next level as a member of our supportive community. Use the coupon Piano Podcast for $100 off an annual membership of Tim's Inner Circle today. To find out more, head to timtopham.com/community.